Happy New Year, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast. 2021, so far, kind of feels the same as 2020, unfortunately. But that's okay. I am here providing you with that content, with that good content, every single week. We got a great episode today. I did this one live on Twitch. Add me on Twitch, twitch.tv/ShaneTold. I'm doing podcasts live on there, but don't worry, they're still going to be right here on this podcast feed every single week, and it's a good one. Michael Jagman of A Skylit Drive, formerly of, I should say, I mean, the band is defunct. He was the man in that band. Now he's doing some awesome new music with a project called Signals. Exciting stuff. But what I love about Michael, or Jag, whatever you want to call him, is he is so forthright, so honest, and on this one, he delivers, man. He doesn't hold back. You are going to learn some stuff about A Skylit Drive, the music industry, how crazy it can be, and what a life that he's had, but he's doing great now. And I want to thank Michael so much for taking the time and talking to me. As always, before we get into that, yes, Twitch, add me on Twitch, twitch.tv/ShaneTold. I am doing tons of stuff on there for this podcast. Also, this is the new shit with Mike. We're doing it live on there, and I'm doing a bunch of stuff, music stuff and whatnot on there as well. So don't sleep on that. If you want to help out the show, of course, we still have the All Access Club. That's growing every day as well. Welcome to all my sinners. New and old, it's awesome. It's really awesome. And of course, if you want to get in touch with me, a good old-fashioned email will do the trick. leadsingersyndrome@gmail.com. That's it. That's all the stuff. So check out that, the All Access Club, Twitch, and you can send me an email. It's all good. It's really, really good. I'm going to experiment with keeping my intro really short. How about that, huh? Happy New Year. Here it is, my conversation with Michael Jagman, formerly of A Skylit Drive and now of Signals. I'm here with Michael Jagman, formerly of A Skylit Drive, band that did a lot of great things for a long time, and now in a new band called Signals. You know, I guess what is best to start out with is just kind of where we're at right now in the world. It doesn't seem like a great time to be launching a new record from a new band when you can't go on tour.
Well, the crazy thing is the years that went into making this record, like we've been writing it since must have been late 2017, early 2018. And I live in Texas and he lives in California. So right. The whole process was done through email. And the first producer fell through.
Oh, yeah.
We teamed up with a record label, which that, you know, at first we were thinking of going DIY and then we changed our minds. And then we got teamed up with another producer who's based all the way out of Australia. Which right. It took a while to find the right producer, considering like the traveling that, you know, that was going between us. We needed somebody who was going to be confident and comfortable with doing everything pretty much through email. Yeah. So we landed with the producer, Jimmy Alexander. He did the New Slaves record as well. So he was awesome to work with. He's probably the nicest producer and just, you know, best all around, you know, dude that I think I've made a record with. And then it just so happened that the timing landed in 2020, that the record was done. And it was honestly planned even late last year that the record was going to come out late this year. So it was one of those things where, again, kind of snowballed into what it became.
Right. Well, the record is out now. It's called Death and Divide. It's an awesome record. I listened to it when it came out, and I just listened to it again just today. You know, to kind of get my feet wet with you and everything to talk about. You know, I guess like you know, one thing you said, like you said to Alt Press, and so I'm going to kind of use their interview for this interview, but I found it really interesting that you came right out and said, you know, I'm used to being in a band where I felt pushed around a lot with a lot of things, pushed to do things I didn't feel were the right direction for my voice. And, you know, now you're working with one other person, which I think tends to maybe help, you know, that creative process. But talk to me a little bit about the differences between making this new Signals record and the other records that you made, you know, in your past with mostly with the Skylet Drive.
Yeah. Well, I think after doing all the records with the Skylet Drive, which even right near the end, I feel like the process that was taken with the Signals record was also kind of the same process as the last Skylet Drive record, because it was just me and the guitarist who pretty much wrote it all. And we did it all a lot from afar. So yeah. it was a really similar process, but John and I have always been close friends. So the band that I mentioned before, Skylet Drive, that gave me the name Jag, that was the band Odd Project, and John was in that band with me. And so him and I remained good friends, right. And then, you know, he would always, you know, send me new music that he was working on, and I was always just really impressed with his talent. And as I started to want to get back into music after kind of taking kind of like a little break from music, you know, early 2016 is kind of when that started, is when John hit me up again and he was like, hey, like check out some of these songs that I've written. And they just blew me away. It was the exact kind of music that I wanted to write over. And I feel like it just, that I could kind of hear where things were going when I first heard the songs, because he already had a lot of the songs put together, and then we wrote a lot of them together as well. But the process was just, it was just fun. I feel like in the past, every record was kind of trying to figure out how we should do it, which, you know, that stresses some people out. They, yeah. You know, some people want to step on other people's toes, be controlling. No, you do more of this. Because I feel like if I listen through every Skylet Drive record, I feel like I sound different on every record. Because right. We were doing something different that I didn't always really want to do. But then again, it was kind of, well, you know, I'm in a band. You're, you know, you got to work with everybody. Where sometimes it was them, and then the producer would get carried away with it, and then I'd get pushed in this whole other direction. Where some records I can't even listen to, because I'm like, I'm totally not happy, and I was miserable when I made the record.
Yeah.
I won't say it out loud, because I don't want anybody else to be like, oh, well, he hates this record. but there's definitely some that were more enjoyable than the others.
Yeah.
And kind of that kind of like, you know, you're in a band. There's some records that you look back and it's like, I had a blast making this one and I hated making that one.
Yeah.
And sometimes those toxic relationships can get, you know, really heavy, and at points they got heavier than others.
No, totally. I've always appreciated how honest and forthright you've been just with when you talk in interviews and stuff. You know, you're kind of an open book, because that can be a rare thing in this world for singers. And I want to get into all that, and I want to talk about Skylet Drive and the whole, you know, your whole career and some of the drama. But I really do want to hear kind of about your humble beginnings a little bit. You know, how you grew up, how you got into this whole thing, how you woke up one day and was like, hey, I can sing, and I can sing really high. So talk to me about the beginning, the early days of how you grew up with your parents and how music kind of entered your world, because I always love that story.
Yeah. Well, for me, it was not a fun, you know, Willy Wonka, Wizard of Oz story. My parents got divorced. I think I was around 6 or 7. I lived with my dad, with kind of on and off between my older brother and my twin sister. And my dad got heavily into drugs. He was a defense lawyer. We lived in Dallas, Texas. And, you know, it really took him down. Like, when the marriage fell apart and then drugs was brought into it, we were now, you know, a product of things that we didn't understand. It was far outside of our scope, considering, you know, my age. My older brother had a much better understanding because he was 3 years older than us. So he was able to kind of see this deterioration from a better scope. Whereas for me, it was just normal life. You know, I woke myself up for school every day starting in third grade. I would wake myself up and make my bowl of cereal, you know, get my lunch money and change. You know, I would have to, you know, wake up my dad as he was passed out to get my money from him. which, you know, which I'm sure I've said it before. I'm sure I was short just about every time, because it's not like I knew exactly how much I needed. I just got as many big coins as I could and would take myself to school. Like, it was walking distance from my house, thankfully. So I would walk myself to school and, you know, like, the whole motto, don't be a fool, stay in school, stuck with me back then. Like, I was like, well, I don't want to be a fool. So I guess that kind of, you know, kickstarted my mentality of being independent and just, you know, working hard for what I want. And then when things hit too far south, I ended up in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which is where I spent the bulk of my teenage years. And that's what also gave me the opportunity to be able to purchase my first musical instrument, which was a bass guitar.
Yeah.
So Kiss was what got me started in music, really.
Gene Simmons,
I saw them on their, you know, reunion tour when they got Peter and Ace back and they got the makeup back on. And I was 11. I made my own shirt and it smelled like, you remember those really thick silver permanent black markers?
Yeah. Yeah.
It smelled awful. So I had this plain Hanes white shirt and I did the whole logo myself. And
nice.
I'm pretty sure, like, you know, I had some kind of kid high just from wearing the shirt because of how strong the fumes were. And I did the makeup myself and everything. And my oldest half brother took me to the show. And that just opened up my world to music. And from that moment on is when I said, this is what I'm going to do.
That's funny. I went to that tour too. I think the same one.
Really?
It would have been like 96?
You got it, 96.
Yeah, I have the actual shirt, the tour shirt.
Oh,
I remember,
wow.
I begged my father. Well, it was weird. It was at the Sky Dome in Toronto, you know, the huge, like, 50,000, you know, seat stadium where the Blue Jays play. And my dad, he used to be, for his company, he was, like, the guy that had all the access to the seats to, like, bring clients or whatever. So, you know, I went to like a few Blue Jays games once in a while, but I was lucky that none of his clients wanted to go see Kiss. I guess they were all old farts and didn't want to go to a rock show. So I was able to, he was able to sneak me in on the corporate seats, and I watched them from a box. And
wow,
and yeah,
awesome.
I guess I was, because I'm a little bit older than you, I would have been like 15. And it was a great show, and I always liked Kiss, man. Ever since, like, it was one of the first songs I ever heard was you know, Kiss Dynasty, and I Was Made for Loving You. That was like when I was a little kid. Yep. I know that's like, they didn't play it at the show, like, they hate that song, but I love Kiss, man. That's cool.
Yeah, what actually bridged me into it was when I learned that they wrote "God Gave Rock and Roll to You," or they.
Oh yeah,
because everybody knows it from the end of
Bill and Ted.
I think it's the second. Yeah. And I was always in love with that song. And then one of those, you remember back in the day, it was like, you know, rock hits, and it would play and it would stream them. And the one that was playing was in all yellow, and it was, and all of a sudden, "God Gave Rock and Roll to You" came up. You know, as it was scrolling down, it was playing it, and I was like, "Oh my God, Kiss wrote that song." And my brother had bought Kiss Alive 3 and he hated it. So, and they played it at that show.
Oh, cool.
Or on that album. And so I took it and I just played the hell out of it.
Yeah.
And then they were really my only musical, you know, anything from age 9 to probably like 13. And then I started getting into, you know, like Def Leppard and Quiet Riot and more of the bands that kind of came right after them, like more in the glam rock era. And then that transitioned into hardcore pop punk and everything else in between there.
Sure. Yeah.
Actually remember listening to you guys. It was in Jackson Hole on our CD listening station, and I was sitting there, and it had like little examples of everything, and I was all like, okay, you know, I'll check this one out. And then that became my favorite record of that time.
Well, thank you, man. That's nice of you to say. That's cool. I want to talk about Kiss one more time, because I didn't get it in, and I always had the same opinion as you of "God Gave Rock and Roll to You." I always thought it was such a banger, but it was like, no one knows about the song, I guess. Like, when you talk about Kiss songs, it's never in on any lists. Like, no one ever talks about it being in like the top 10, 15, 20 Kiss songs. Is it just a, like, I'm not as well versed in the Kiss discography as I should be. Is it on any of the records, or is it just on that soundtrack?
It's just Alive 3. I mean, far as I know, it's only on Kiss Alive 3. And all those Alive records, they didn't actually, like, sure, they had a big performance and they did track certain parts, but then of course they would, you know, if things didn't pan out, you know, if they didn't get, you know, like the crowd, you know, like the audience just where they wanted it, they would, you know, like they admitted to like retracking things to make the record what it sounded like in the end.
Right. No, that's super cool.
That's the only place that I know of that has that song, yeah, aside from the soundtrack.
Well, you talk a little bit about, I'm going to jumping around a little bit here, but while we're on the topic of, you know, you saying that my band, you listened to my band, we were somewhat of an influence on you, which is kind of cool. You made a record with Cameron Webb, didn't you? Who produced, yep, a couple Silverstein records. I remember Cameron actually like hitting me up when he was working with you guys and talking about it and saying how you guys like loved us. And I was like, oh, it's kind of cool. I think we toured together before that. And I didn't really know. But how was that experience working with Cameron? Cause I mean, we made like two records and he mixed a couple. So, and he's one of the best people.
Oh yeah. Yeah. He was great to work with. And I really like, he was probably the first producer that, I think especially for like a singer, because me in the studio, I hate being crowded, you know, like that's when, you know, your voice tightens up. You don't feel as comfortable.
Yeah.
You maybe have a couple people in the room, and he was the first producer where as soon as I, like him and I were working on one song, and then a few of the guys came in back into the room, because you know his studio, you can see straight through the glass, through the drum room.
Yeah.
Did you ever go to the studio that's, yeah, in Santa Ana?
Yeah, we recorded Discovering the Waterfront there. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So then I could see him directly, and then he could immediately notice the difference in my voice as soon as a few people entered the room, and he just literally stopped it. And he said, you guys got to get the hell out of here. And they're like, why? And he was like, cause you guys are messing him up. Like it was all like, let us do our thing. And then if you guys want to tweak stuff, we'll talk about it later.
Yeah.
And he was the first producer where I was like, oh, you can do that. And,
sure.
And it was awesome to get that support.
Yeah. Well, he's always funny to me because he's like that. He'll like have these like rules. Like I remember we had the rule when we were making Discovering the Waterfront that no one was allowed to smoke weed or drink until it got dark at night, until the sun went down, which was okay because it was like January or February when we made the record. So it got dark early anyway. But then it was just funny. He'd have these rules. And sometimes he was kind of strict on it, and other times he'd just like mess around for like 2 hours, like, you know, he's like, because he's such a wacky personality. But in the end, I like that about him, because, you know, he was able to be serious when he had to be and be joking around when he had to be, you know, and it just overall, it made the process really fun. But that's I love that you recorded there. That's like,
yeah,
I can picture that place like the back of my hand, you know.
Yeah, it's actually funny because as we were going through tracking, like he even mentioned at one point, like he was like, oh, you and Shane like to do things the same, like as for how you stagger things and stuff.
Right.
And but yeah, so then we did Identity on Fire with him, and then we did the Separate Ways Journey cover. That's the first thing that we did with him.
Yeah, cool.
And that was just lots of fun. You know, he had great ideas for how to make it our own and everything. And it was definitely, that was the highlight of that album, was definitely getting to track it with him. He was just he was a lot of fun.
Yeah, man, he's the best, man. So you know, you go from, you know, this, I don't know, Kiss and Silverstein, you know, and you get a bass guitar. So, and you're from Wyoming, which, like, let's be clear, I highly doubt is much of a scene hotspot there for music. So talk to me about how, you know, you, first of all, how you figured out, hey, I got a voice and I've got like a unique voice. I don't think, I'm sure that a lot of that is natural. I don't think you worked for that range. And then your foray kind of into, you know, Odd Project, and then all the other, you know, musical projects that you're still, you know, that you're doing now.
Well, I mean, initially, really, like when I first started in music, I was just like, oh, I just want to be Gene Simmons. So I, you know, I took bass lessons, and that's what got me started. And I was always told, like, they're like, well, you should just take guitar lessons, because if you learn guitar, then you know how to play bass. And I was always like, no, shut up. And so, you know, like I would try to make things different and, you know, try to do like power chords even on bass. And that's when I kind of realized that what I really wanted to do was geared more towards guitar.
Okay.
And then I got my first guitar, and, you know, I would, you know, just sit there and like listen to the songs and try to learn them by ear. Cause, you know, being in Wyoming, you don't really have many resources for really anything other than there was a record shop. So, and I didn't know how to read music. Like, I didn't take any kind of music lessons. So right. I taught myself any song that I liked. I would just sit there and play it out in my head. And then once I had it, I had it. And then I started playing in bands in my freshman year of high school. I was a drummer for the high school band. And it was the very first pep rally. So, like, the homecoming pep rally was always, like, first week of school, pretty much. And, you know, I'm down there. I've got, like, my spiky hair and, you know, my band shirt on, and you know, so I was up there drumming, and then this group of seniors came up to me afterwards, and they were like, "Hey man, we got a band, you want to be our drummer?" And I was like, "Well, I actually don't drum outside of school, but I play guitar." And they're like, "Okay. Oh, well, we need a second guitarist." And I was like, "All right, cool." So I went over to one of their houses, and we jammed, and, you know, we did covers of, you know, like Converge and Hatebreed, oh, yeah, and like, okay, okay, and, you know, like, and, you know, some of that earlier, you know, like hardcore stuff. And that's what got me started really playing in a band. And then as we started going through the years of me going through high school, you know, you start to hear the transition of how Killswitch Engage started to where they ended up. You know, adding more singing, adding more choruses. There were more hardcore bands now transitioning to metalcore. And so everybody was like, "Well, who can sing?" And at that point, I didn't know I could sing. I was like, "I guess I'll try." And so they're like, "Well, I guess this is the chorus. Let's just try to write something." So then I quickly became the person who did all the singing choruses. Well, of course, the front man did all of the screaming. And then as I was going through that band, there was one other band in our town who was the pop punk band. And as I was getting more into bands like Finch and The Used and Taking Back Sunday and you guys, I was like, "Well, I want to do something that's more in this realm while these guys want to do more of the metalcore stuff."
Right.
So then I formed a three-piece where I was then still playing guitar and doing all of the singing. And so it was just me, my buddy John, not the same John as Signals, and then our drummer Brody. So, you know, we did more of that, I guess, screamo type stuff. And then after high school, like, we were all dead set on moving to Southern California and you know, making an honest, you know, pitch at it. So we moved out there. That's when I quickly learned that nobody really wanted to work on the band. You know, I would go and I would walk around, like, the malls, and I'd wait after Chain Reaction shows, and I'd hand out flyers that I had made in, like, paint. They looked like garbage. and you know that broken-hearted feel of handing it to someone, and then literally 5 seconds you see it float back because they had already dropped it on the ground.
Right.
So I went through all that when I first moved to California, and started auditioning for other bands because I realized that the band I moved there with wasn't really, they didn't, you know, really want to do it anymore, I guess. Like, once they got there, it's like, "Oh man, like, this is real. Like, we need, like, real jobs and stuff." You know, I struggled for a long time. I worked at Hot Topic, and all I would eat for the day is, like, the dollar menu from McDonald's. I'd get a double cheeseburger and a small fry. And I always had the exact amount. It was like $2.14.
Oh, man. And you still remember.
Oh, yeah. And then at night I would have ramen or something. And then, you know, Taco Tuesday at Del Taco was always, like, the moment, because I'd get, like, 9 tacos for, like, $3. And after, you know, it's like being on, like, Survivor and getting, like, a reward. Like, I was like, on Tuesday, I would just feast with all my tacos.
Oh, man.
And then I'd go right back to, you know, struggling and everything. And it was in that period of time that, you know, I found out that the band Odd Project was looking for a band for a new frontman.
Yeah.
And I was like, "I feel like I've seen them before. Like, I've heard their name a lot." Like, their name was always thrown around a lot in the Southern California scene. You know, kind of how, you know, like, Stick to Your Guns was always, like, a really strong, like, Orange County band for a long time. And then, you know, things catapulted for them. But Odd Project kind of had that in the early days of, you know, they would always headline Chain Reaction and have some other bands play under them. So I auditioned for them, ended up joining them. I did an album. But the band was kind of disintegrating as I joined them. Like, as soon as I was joining, like, two of the guys were just so over it because I didn't realize how long they had been looking for a singer. It had been, like, a year. So they were just kind of over it by the time I came in, and then we had to replace them, which one of the replacements was John on bass. And then, you know, some of the other kind of friends within their group filled in some of the other pieces. And then we put out that album. We did, like, 2 little tours where one of them, we took my mom's Ford Excursion. I had to fly out to Wyoming and drive it back to Southern California. And wow. Like, we would all sleep in it. It was miserable. You know, like, we blew a tire out all the way up in, like, the Northeast. And have you ever heard of the band Spoken?
No. I don't think so.
Oh, man. We'll definitely check them out. But okay. They were the nicest dudes ever. You know, they walked up to me after our last show on the tour, which half of it had been canceled because bands were just dropping like flies. I'm sure you've been in that boat before where it's just this tour destined to fail before it even starts. And, you know, he slips me $100 because he was like, man, I know that you guys have to get home and you have a busted tire. Wow. So I hope this helps. Wow. Yeah. And I'll always remember stuff like that.
Sure.
You know, like, they were just like the sweetest dudes ever. And once Odd Project was clearly kind of like moving on my way out, I then joined this little like garage band who pretty much just did Iron Maiden covers.
You got the voice for that.
Odd Project wasn't like clearly done. It was just like, I didn't know what we were doing anymore. And I still wanted to play music. I was like, I have this itch. And I went and auditioned for these guys and they were so freaking talented. I mean, they could cover Iron Maiden like, you know, like nothing I had ever seen. And I was like, well, I mean, is this something that you guys want to do? And of course, at the time, they're like, oh, yeah. But, you know, it's kind of like a rare, you know, blood type or something. Somebody who's willing to kind of literally take all these steps back in life to try to do it. You know, it's almost like you walk to the edge and it's like, well, hold on. What do I have to sacrifice to do this? Oh, I don't know if I want to do that anymore. Yeah. And I think that's what I came to with that group. And then that's when A Skylit Drive came into the fold. I actually auditioned for two bands at the same time. I auditioned for Versa Emerge.
Oh, really?
And I actually wrote the first single that they put out with Sierra. I actually wrote all the melodies for that song.
Crazy.
I was a little bitter about it. I won't lie. They just changed the words. And I was like, oh, man, well, whatever. I flew all the way out to Florida. I tried out for them. You know, super nice dudes. And then I actually wrote Dance Gavin Dance because they were looking for a singer too. I just never heard back. And then I wrote Hit the Lights as well. They were another band I reached out to, but didn't hear back. But then it was actually two of the guys in A Skylit Drive wrote me literally within 5 minutes of each other. You know, to be like, yeah, man, you know, like, we want you to come try out. I know only like the week before I went out, Telly from Now the Word Alive, he had actually tried out for A Skylit Drive too. So him and I kind of crossed. There are so many moving parts like going on at that time where I was like, I didn't really care where I landed. I was like, I'll move to Florida. I'll move up to Northern California. Yeah. I'll move to this place. So, like, wherever Hit the Lights are from, maybe it's Ohio or something, but I just had my eyes on it. And I was like, this is what I want to do. And if I can't find a band out here who's going to do it, I'm just going to figure it out.
Yeah.
And then A Skylit Drive landed and started 2008, that kind of catapulted. I picked up and moved from Southern California to Northern. It was only like 2 weeks after I joined that I was like, all right, so where am I living?
Wow. Which Versa Emerge song was it that you wrote? You ever see any royalties from that? Nothing?
No. And it's funny because a kid actually caught wind of it and they posted something on YouTube and they sent me a link and they were all like, yeah, because I had shown him the demo that I did. And I didn't think he was going to do anything with it. And then he went and he posted it on YouTube and literally within like an hour, it was taken down for like the, you know,
really?
Like, infringing of trademarks or whatever. Let me see if I can find the song. Let me just look it up real
fast.
That's
super funny. That's super funny, man. No. Well, yeah, it sounds like you were, you know, you were a hot commodity there. I mean, you know, trying out for all these bands and you know, you made a little bit of a name for yourself kind of with Odd Project. And it's no surprise that with A Skylit Drive, you started to, you know, get a lot of success and, you know, you guys started to blow up. And, you know, I remember hearing about you guys and saying to myself, like, oh, we got to get these guys on one of our tours. You know, they're really making some big waves. So talk to me about the growth of A Skylit Drive from, you know, when you joined, you know, starting to see this uptick and just kind of how it affected you and the band and everything, because sometimes success has a way of, you know, changing things.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I, you know, things just kind of kept falling into place, like not nicely, like most people would think, like, you know, nicely is, you know, they all live where you already live. You can still live with your parents and, you know, you don't have to really worry about things. But I always kind of like floated around. Like I lived with one member for a while, got an apartment, couldn't afford it anymore, went back. And I was always kind of like floating between, because all of them grew up there. So they all, you know, still got to kind of, you know, stay in the rooms that they were in fifth grade and, you know, just kind of coast through things. And and I was always kind of going in and out between. And then I even moved back down to Southern California after like a certain number of years, because I just didn't really like living up there. Like I was like, I mean, nobody sees each other unless we're getting ready for a tour or unless we're riding. So I was like, I can just drive up. It's like a, you know, 5-6 hour drive. Yeah. And I would make that drive. So, you know, it's like, all right, it's time to get ready for like a tour, go up like a week early. They will have already been practicing for a week to get the music down. And then I would kind of show up for the last week before it to, you know, get things into tour shape.
Sure.
You know, nothing's worse than playing the first show and feeling awesome. Second show feeling not quite as good. And then like the third through like the seventh is like this like callousing of the vocal cords, you know, to get it like tour ready.
Right. No, that's another interesting thing too, that you say about how, you know, you guys didn't hang out. I guess like, you know, you knew each other, you were friends on tour, but you didn't hang out. And a lot of bands are different like that, you know? And for some bands that can work really well, having more of a professional relationship where like, you know, you guys are still friends, but you aren't seeing each other, you know? Cause I remember, I think it was We Came as Romans, you know, they were all like best friends in Michigan and Royal Oak, you know, and they would all go home from tour and like that night they're at the same bar, you know, and like I always think of like, dude, man, after 2 months in a van with somebody, I need a little break, you know, so it can be healthy. But I guess like you also need to be close. It's a weird, you know, it's a weird little duality there.
Yeah. Well, it was just, it was kind of depressing up where they lived. Cause I, you know, I grew up in a small town. So it's like, you know, I spent age like 11 to like 18 in this small town with almost no resources. And, you know, you just kind of like, you know, make your own fun. Like there's no cool stores or anything. You just, you know, and for me, I was usually like a little jerk. I would run around and like raise havoc and make dry ice bombs and, you know, like do whatever kind of trouble that we could get into.
Sure.
But that was something that was kind of sad, like when I first moved up there, is that I quickly realized that nobody hung out with each other. And so I lived with our keyboardist and his parents. And yeah, like everybody just kind of did their own thing. And I didn't have anybody up there. I didn't have any friends because I didn't know anybody. They were the only people I knew. Right. And so after, you know, a couple of years of that is when I moved back down to Southern California, because I knew people. And I was like, you know, like my parents live down here now, so I at least have more to kind of go to, you know, to go hang out and not be so alone, I guess.
Yeah, well, you know, you talk about your keyboard player of Scarlet Drive and living with his parents, and, you know, you were pretty clear about some embezzlement and money stolen by his father, who was your business manager. And, you know, that's another thing that doesn't get talked about on this show that happens, and that's, you know, money disappearing from bands. You know, obviously, like a lot of people in bands, they're artistic people. They're not that good at business, maybe, or they've trusted the wrong people. They're just, you know, you're on tour like somewhere and like, I don't know, here, just take the money. And like, and then there's all these different bills to pay and you don't always know. It's hard to connect the dots. But I mean, I heard $200,000 he stole, you found out somehow. I mean, if you can talk about that, I mean, I don't know if there was any legal issues or whatever. I mean, I imagine maybe, but it's also someone's family member, so that's complicated. But I mean, that must have been a big part of the demise of the band.
So, like, once we started learning about it, there were really only three people actually in the band. You know, like we had two guys who were, you know, like touring guys. Like they didn't, you know, like have any kind of like claim of anything.
Hired guns.
Yeah. So then they were in it, and but yeah, like they were hired guns, and so there were only really three of us who were still like contracted with anybody, like when it came to labels and such.
Right.
And it was right around the last tour that we did. It was an Escape the Fate headliner, and you know, like we all knew that we were going to take a breather from touring. It was just, it had kind of hit that time where it was like, well, so-and-so hired Gunn, we can't stand, so, like, we're going to have to regroup, and we're going to have to find somebody to replace that, and it was, like, everybody's hurting financially. You know, I knew at the time that my wife was pregnant, so, you know, like, my vote was, like, let's take a little bit of a breather, and everybody was just like, yes, like, we need to, like, regroup, like, you know, so-and-so wants to go get a job, and kind of, like, and we also needed to write the new record, so it was a perfect time to step back and reevaluate where we were. And that's right when we found out it was another member's mom who had hired an accountant to look at the numbers because, you know, I lived with them and it was the weirdest thing ever. I would always try to, you know, be involved in watching the finances, but I was never like allowed to. It was weird. I would go downstairs and he'd be on his computer and I was like, hey, can I get the login for the banking stuff? You know, just for like this last quarter of the tour, I lost track of a few things and I just kind of want to, you know, cross everything off. And then he was like, I'll never forget his story on not giving it to me was that if he gave it to me, it would throw off the privacy settings or something. And I was like, we're on the same IP address. Like, I'm under your roof. It's a computer at your house. Like, how is it going to throw anything off? You just give me the password. And he's like, no, because then it'll kick me out and then I won't be able to get back in. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, that's so weird. I can go log into my bank from my phone, from this computer, from another computer
so
over
you
there.
You felt like right there was something fishy going on.
Yeah, which, I mean, like, I knew long before that as well that something was fishy because, I mean, I even sat down with our manager back in the early days. And I was like, is there any way to get him out of, like, the kind of control he has? Because I was able to see that his name was on everything. He had his own card to our bank account. Like, he's the only person who had his own card to our bank account. So, and then his son, you know, he had the name on the other card. So there was, so, you know, there was Chris and his son, and then they both said a Skylet Drive Inc. underneath it. Nobody else had those cards. And it was always just odd to me just how like controlling he was of things. Like, we would get halfway through a tour and he would always tell his son, you know, like, don't do deposits, just wait until you get home and I'll deposit it for you. So we would be carting around like, you know, stupid amounts of money in a 15 passenger van. Like we ended up having to make like a hidden compartment under one of like the cup holders, like in the side because we got broken into once and the people were kind of dumb. They didn't take the money box. They took like tons of other stuff, but it was like too close of a scare that it was like, I mean, he always has us hold on to so much money that we need to hide it.
That
and then now
no
looking back, I'm like, well,
all.
That's why he wanted us to hold it is because he didn't want it to go into the bank first because then there's a paper trail.
Yeah.
And back then, you know, like we didn't have all of the card machines. Like if you had a card machine, it worked at like five venues out of the whole tour and all the others, they try to plug it in. They're like, I don't have a signal.
Yeah.
And so then you couldn't use a card.
No. And people weren't used to pay like back then. You know, everyone was like, everyone knows you bring cash to a show. Like, no one expects a credit card machine. These days, everyone expects a credit card machine, which is kind of tough for us. Like, you know, us being Canadian, we always had problems in the past with that. With, like, you know, we wouldn't have a U.S. bank account, so we wouldn't be able to deposit money. Obviously, now that's changed. But, yeah, it was a major problem. But, yeah, like, you just get a Bank of America account, and you could literally just either go to the bank during the day, or you could even just drop cash in a bank machine and there's a paper trail and everything. Like, carrying money around is stupid. I remember I left $7,000 in a Red Roof Inn once.
Oh,
my fault. we were in, this is in the pretty early days. And we were in Dallas, and it was a show where, you know, and I'm sure you did this too in your young van days, you know, where you would play a show and then we would just start driving. And what we would try to do is like get a hotel in the morning, like in the city we were going to play the next day. Cause sometimes if you got the hotel room in the morning, you'd get it for an extra night. You know what I mean?
No.
Like if you check in at 7 a.m., then they'll give it to you all day so you can sleep. But then you also get the next night. So we used to do that sometimes when we could. So we stayed at the Red Roof Inn and we were there for like a day and a half. And I had the band money briefcase, which it was so stupid. It was like one of those silver briefcases that like actually looks like the kind of thing you would carry thousands of dollars in. And we had that, and I left it. I like put it under the bed of the Red Roof Inn, and then we left and, you know, just drove. And I think we stopped for gas, you know, like 2 hours later, and was like, where's the briefcase? And I just like, you know, it hit me. I was like, like, oh God, it's still under the bed, isn't it? So we were like, oh shit, well, we got to call the Red Roof Inn. So I don't know which Red Roof it is in. It is in Dallas. There's like, you know, 8 or 9 of them. So I started going through the like Red Roof Inn book that we had, because we loved staying at Red Roof Inn, and just started calling all of them and was like, hey, do you have, I left this thing? Don't know who I'm talking about. Okay. And eventually like I called one, I think it was like the 6th or 7th one I called, and they were like, yep, we got it. It's here. And it was locked. So they didn't open it. They didn't know what was in it. And we drove back and we got the briefcase, and it was fine, but I never made that mistake again.
Man, that is crazy. Yeah, it is crazy. Some of the things that you do when you're younger, I mean, you know, like just like you were saying, like, I don't know if it's just a, you know, guys in bands of being way too trusting and just like naive when you're younger, that you're just so excited of like, yeah, it's like, oh, hey, like this is so much fun, and these people act like they're taking care of you. And then, you know, you learn maybe one out of those 50 people actually had your best interest in mind. And then all these other people just kind of cut you at your knees every which way you go. Like, oh, they're young. They're not paying attention to this stuff. They're just out there having a good time. Yeah. And it wasn't until we got like later on that I really started like hunkering down and getting like stricter on the numbers. Like I started doing like a lot of our tour managing. I'm pretty sure actually, I'm not sure if it was the tour that we did with you guys. And, you know, Chiodos and LSA. I'm not sure if I was doing the tour manager quite that early. But at one point I was just like, yeah, I mean, we don't really need a tour manager. Like, let's get somebody to maybe help like this side of things. But finances, I'll just handle it. Right. I'll pay the crew and everything. And I'm going to give you guys all like an Excel sheet at the very end.
Right.
So that it was like clear cut and dry. But come that time is when a lot of the damage had been done. And a lot of it was what we didn't know was done being used through like a debit card. So being used regularly at a local casino, like we'd be in like New York, and there were charges of like 300 something bucks being pulled out at this casino. And it was like, oh, well, I wonder who that could be. The only other person with, with the card. So it was just this huge mess. And then an agreement was struck where like a second property had to get sold to pay back all the members, which still fell below, you know, like that kind of like minimum mark. Like we knew there was more, but a lot of, like some stuff was harder to prove, but there was nothing in writing as to this agreement. It was just like, will you guys not sue me if I just pay you guys this amount of money? And then after that, we, you know, dissolved the corporation and everybody kind of went in their separate ways, really.
Wow, dude. Well, man, I mean, that's obviously a big thing. I mean, you say you didn't have a tour manager or you were doing the work, but I remember touring with you guys, and definitely you seem to have your head on your shoulders pretty good and tight, but some of the guys in your band, and I won't name names, I mean, I saw some craziness with your band. I mean, that tour we did, you mentioned it, it was Chiodos and Silverstein, we were co-headlining, and I remember we absorbed a tour that was supposed to be happening, which was Escape the Fate, you guys and Alisana. And I remember we just made this mega tour and it was awesome, but it was like crazy mode with all the, you know, 5 bands and all the crew and everything.
That was the tour that not only like after the Kiss thing, that was probably like the next monumental thing. That's not to stroke your ego or anything, but I was like, oh, thanks, holy dude. Shit, I'm touring with freaking Silverstein and Chiodos. Like I was like, this is like this is the moment. And it's like, this is what I've been like waiting for is this tour. And I'll tell everybody that's still what I say is that was my favorite tour. Hands down, that was my favorite tour.
Yeah. No, it was a good one, man. Thanks for coming on. Let's talk about the end of the band. I mean, it wasn't that long ago. I don't know what you want to say. I mean, sometimes you reflect back and it's okay, but it seemed like you and I think it was Nick, you know, kind of came to I guess you said you guys just couldn't get past the differences you had. He made a statement. You said that's not true. This is how it really is. It sounds like there isn't going to be a Scarlet Drive reunion tour that anytime soon, to say the least.
I wouldn't really imagine so. I mean, like a lot of cuts went deep, and it was one of those things where a lot of our turmoil was behind the scenes, and I kind of wanted it to stay that way. Like I was like, you know, you and I have our differences. You and I never really got along. At a certain point, we found a mutual business understanding where we liked the way that we wrote together, and that was our relationship, was that it was like we wrote well together, but everything else was just kind of like, you know, two passing ships. And we always kind of had this mutual understanding that it was like, you know, like we see like what's important out of this relationship, and let's just keep it healthy. Like, you know, like let's nurture this because it means a lot to both of us. And then that was kind of the first bridge that was burnt. Was I woke up one day to my wife texting me, and she was like, you need to go look at the band Facebook page. I was like, oh, okay. And then I checked my emails, and that's where I'd gotten this notification that I had been booted as an admin from the Facebook page. And I was like, all right, here we go. And so I go and I read it, and it's this complete BS post of like, happy-go-lucky, he's happy for me that I'm having a kid. And I was like, dude, if I screenshotted some of the texts and stuff, like it was like, you're not happy. Like you're bitter about a lot of stuff. And there were months that went by where we didn't say anything. And I would try to draft stuff with our manager at the time. And I was like, well, we should say something to people so that they understand what's going on. Cause we know what we're doing. We know that we're writing music and we're taking some time, but we haven't told anybody this. And so like the manager and I would, you know, put together different posts of, you know, well, you know, Jag's having a kid and, you know, they're taking time to write the record and just kind of regrouping things. And it was always shot down. It was like, well, no, it's too much about you. And I was like, well, I mean, that's part of what's going on, though. We should just talk about everything that's going on. Like, I mean, like, you can include your story in there. I mean, like, tell me what you're doing. And I was like, that's fine. This is just a draft. And it never got approved, and it was argued about, so then it finally got dropped. And then the next post was a lot of the wording that I had used with the manager. He then took a lot of it to make it sound, like, supportive. And it was like, it's this amicable thing, and it's like, no, it's not mutual at all. Like, I didn't know this was happening. Like, I didn't know that this post was going to go up. And so that kind of kickstarted a lot of the, now it's in the open, you know, like now I kind of have to like defend that, you know, like a lot of our career was putting up these fake fronts of like, you know, I'm sure that there were some members at some point, or you've seen bands who complain on the way to a signing. It's like, oh, I've got to go do this.
Right.
I mean, it was constant. It was constant. And then they get there and it's all smiles and it's all like, dude, like, you know, like these people are coming here and they want to just meet you. They want to shake your hand. I mean, like, this is what you've been dreaming of, is that you get to do this kind of stuff. It should be nurtured. It should be appreciated. And, you know, like whether you're feeling it or not, it's an experience that not a lot of people get to do. And that was kind of the story of a lot of things, was always this facade. And that was the final point of like, you don't put a facade on this. You don't put a fake front on what's going on. If you're going to open up about it, just be real. Say, this is what happened. Lots of money was stolen. We disagreed about, you know, like how the money should go and everything. And that's fine that we disagreed, but don't then tell a story that didn't happen. And that's what I didn't want, was I just didn't want everybody to think, oh, well, you know, nothing awful happened, which awful things did happen, and I felt like it deserved to be heard.
Sure. Well, damn, dude. Well, I'm sorry to hear that you went through that and everything. And, you know, I felt like, you know, Scarlet Drive was just always a band that was always there and always continued to make good records. But I do think that, you know, Signals and what you're doing right now is really exciting and really good and really uplifting. I mean, the record is out now. Death and Divide. Did this come out on a label or anything? What are you guys doing for the release of this? And how's that going? Because I'm sure you've learned a lot, you know, and we talked about the music industry and business side of things.
Yeah. So then the album came out on SBG Records. It's Shandan Horan. It's his label. So like Slaves and I know like Max from Escape the Fate. I think it's Violent New Breed. I think that they're on there too. Cool. So it's just something where, you know, like when I first had a conversation with Shandan, he really had this a really good understanding of what I wanted to do with it. Cause I was like, I mean, I don't think we're not going to hit the road. We're not going to go jump in a van. Like, you know, it's, I feel a little too old to start over, but I still wanted to make music and I still wanted to put it out. And I was like, you know, I love doing that so much that I was like, I want the record to be put out. I just don't want to go into it like with this, you know, expectation of you're going to hit the road for X amount of days. And I was like, and that's fine if you don't want to do that. You know, I just look at it as more of like a novelty thing. Like I was like, it is more of like a novelty project. But then COVID hit and all of a sudden everybody's on this level playing field because nobody's touring. And I was like, well,
yeah, okay.
So now our record comes out and it's like everybody else's. Cause I sure. mean, you know, nobody gets to tour. So I was all like, well, I mean, like this will be interesting to see how things pan
yeah.
out.
Very interesting.
And you're like, we've got plans to do, you know, like I think Goldfinger was one of the first bands that I saw like doing their whole like quarantine sessions or something.
Yep.
And I was like, oh, like that's so cool. You know, so we plan on doing, you know, like stuff like that to make up for performances and, you know, be as interactive as possible. Cause, you know, I mean, again, we spent years writing this record and it's something that I think John and I have always wanted to make. It's a record that I feel like should have come, you know, kind of like earlier in my, you know, in my musical career. You know, if I could nudge it into the timeline of a Skylet Drive Records, then I would.
Right. Yeah.
Just because of like, how proud I am of what we were able to do from afar. And he's easily the most, you know, gifted musical mind I think I've ever worked with. You know, it's just been like an insane pleasure to do this record. And I think it's the first time that versus everybody saying, this is our best record, this one's doing this, this one means so much for this. I'm like, I'm just simply the most proud of this one because of, you know, where things were and where things are.
Absolutely, man. Well, cool. Well, I'm going to open the floor right now to some questions here on Twitch. I encourage you to throw up any questions you may have for Mr. Jag. Michael Jag Jagman, and he will answer them, and it will be really, really great. So that's good, man. Dude, this has been really, really, really awesome, man. How's it going with being a dad, you know, these days, and I guess having a little more time at home?
I mean, you know, thankfully, like what I do for regular work, you know, like wasn't impacted by the pandemic and everything. So, you know, like my wife and I, we did, you know, like what we could even, you know, help some families out, you know, like, you know, kind of put feelers out there if, you know, if somebody needs help and, you know, like we're more than willing to help you out if you're in one of those bad positions. So like, that's been like a really big focus of ours, but yeah, being at home, my youngest is with me every day. So yeah. I work right here and, you know, my dog snores right here and, and, you know, like the fact that she hasn't barged in here is beyond me. I'm pretty sure my wife's just doing a good job of hanging out with her. But, you know, she's four and she's just a ball of fun and energy and loves to love on him and comes in here. I'll be on a call or something. She just wants to sit there and talk to me. I mean, it's definitely been an interesting year. It'll be one I'll never forget for multiple reasons. I mean, nobody will, you know, you've got the worst year ever, but within that worst year, you know, some really special things, you know, for me happened and, you know, having a family now and, you know, being all the way back out in Texas, cause I started in Texas and Dallas and went up to Wyoming, California, up California, down California, back to Texas.
Right. Right. Well, there's a question right here, from Swalama. I don't know if you can see that on the screen there, but, what brought you to Texas? I guess it should say what brought you back to Texas. You know, you've been a person that's traveled all over the place. What was it about, you know, Austin, Texas that led you there? Was it work? Was it, you know, your partner or what was it?
So what brought me back, was my now wife, Lindsay. So that's what brought me back to Texas. So I was in Southern California and then just, you know, it was time to, you know, find my next path. And she was that path. You know, I was still in the Skylet Drive at that time. So I was already traveling to meet up with them, but it had already kind of reached that point where, you know, a lot of the work was being done by kind of two people. So it didn't really matter where we were. We were always going to be able to meet up.
Yep.
So, you know, I knew that my future was here with her and here I am.
Awesome. Awesome. Here's a question from Corey Motionless. Hello, Corey. Jag, fave game or ASD song you wrote? Okay. Game?
That's tricky. I'll try to answer both. It's been a while since I've played a video game just because of, you know, you got a young one running around and yep. you work all throughout the week. You got to really divvy out on what's important for those hours that you have. But the last game that I probably really liked, I think it was called The Death Within. It was on PS4, I think. It was kind of this like suspense third-person game. That one was a lot of fun. And ASD song I wrote, I always thought that our best song ever was Too Little Too Late. I think that's our the best of Scarlet Drive song.
What about it? Why do you feel that way about it? I mean, you know, everyone has their own, you know, opinions and everything. But I mean, that's not a song like I wouldn't say that's one of your hits. Would you say? I mean, no, I wouldn't say so.
Yeah. Too Little Too Late is definitely up there. So then Too Little Too Late was on the record that we did with Cameron.
Okay.
So that one, like the big songs off that one seemed to be like Too Little Too Late was probably the number one off that. And then the Cali right. Buds was kind of right there behind that one. But yeah, Too Little Too Late was the first like single, that Fearless really got behind.
Okay.
But yeah, it was just something about that song. It was just really fluent. I remember they wrote all the music and we were staying at a Motel 6. And I thought of the melody for a lot of it while taking a shower. And, you know, I quickly got out. And, like, pretty much every melody I ever think of, if I don't sing it into a memo in my phone,
it's
then
gone.
I'll forget it probably.
Yeah.
So, like, I have countless, like, you know, like, all of a sudden you hit play and it's a... And then me, like, you know, like, quietly singing a melody or something because I'm in, like, a big room or something. Or I went into, like, a public restroom and I'm like, oh, I just got this melody and I can't forget it. So I have countless of those memos. So my phone would probably be pretty funny if somebody ever found it.
that's super funny. No, I was just looking at your Spotify top 10. And that, you know, that song's not in there. You know, it's but hey, you got a lot of songs on a lot of albums, and that just shows your, you know, the band had a lot of, you know, good yeah. music. You kind of already answered this question, but you know, do you have any plans to do Signal stuff? I mean, you said maybe.
I mean, like, my plan is that I definitely want to perform because I love performing. I just don't imagine us actually touring.
Right.
You know, just like with most people, you know, like, you see a lot of festivals getting rescheduled and so on. But I feel like just touring has this huge question mark on it. I think even for bands where that's their goal is to go back to it. So I don't put too much emphasis on touring. I definitely want to perform. It's just a matter of when the opportunity presents itself. You know, like, does it make sense for us? Like, of course, we're a two-man band, so we would have to, you know, get some people to do it with us. You know, like, there's some coordinating to handle in there. But I think that, you know, if and when the opportunity presents itself, then we'll, you know, happily jump on top of it. And then actually, Swalama over here corrected me. The video game I talked about was The Evil Within.
Ah, okay. Okay. There we go. Yes, The Evil Within. Thank you, Swalama.
Yeah.
All right, man. Well, hey, I'll let you go. One final question from Patrick MS89. I don't know if this is a... if this is a inside joke, but I would love to know your honest opinion of Reno, Nevada.
It almost seems like an inside joke. I mean, we didn't play in Reno too many times, but all I remember was Reno was the night that, and I won't name names, but one of our guitarists was when we sent him back home to not finish the tour with us.
Oh, okay.
You know, drug issues and so on, where it was like, well, if we don't do it now, then, I mean, and it's something that we had talked about for a long time. It was a known problem, and it was like, it's not helping him being out here. It's not helping us. We need to just kind of truck through this. And, like, overnight, we had to find a way to, you know, like, dub in his second guitar parts and everything because we didn't have a second, you know, guitarist now. So, like, that was tricky, but that's probably my, you know, unfortunately, I'm sorry if there was, like, a certain show or anything, but for some reason, that's just what completely clouds my mind when I think of Reno.
I have a couple great Reno stories, but one of the craziest things, we were on tour with Rise Against. This is back in, like, 2007.
And they
did this crazy, like, two-leg tour where they played, like, everywhere. And it was, that was, like, right when they started blowing up on the radio. So there were certain shows that were massive. Like, we played Red Rocks in Colorado. We played Long Beach Arena, but then we played Reno in this like little tiny club, which was strange. But somebody like pepper sprayed someone in the crowd of the show, boy. And they had to evacuate the whole building.
Yeah,
it was like the most crazy thing. And then another time we spent Thanksgiving in Reno. Actually a sick place to be on Thanksgiving because everything's actually open, you know, like all the casinos and stuff. So we went to this restaurant in Reno and we brought this like vegan food that we bought, frozen vegan food, and they actually heated it up in the oven for us. And we had this like lovely Thanksgiving meal in Reno. So I've got great memories and not so great memories about Reno, but it's a one of a kind place, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like Austin, you know, like not a lot of tours stop in Austin because I don't know if it's just, you know, people in Austin are more flexible with driving to either San Antonio or Dallas or Houston. Like, of course, people who aren't from Texas don't realize or don't know kind of like the triangle that surrounds Austin. Yeah. Like Austin sits in the middle. You got Houston 3 hours away. You've got Dallas 3 hours away. And then you got San Antonio an hour and a half away. So it's always odd when I see bands like in our niche play Austin because it's usually one of the other three because Austinites are willing to make the drive. Whereas like the Austin shows, it's usually like people in Dallas are like, oh, they'll come to Dallas next time. And the same for the other two cities is what it seems.
Yep. No, absolutely. Well, Michael, Jag, whatever to call you. I feel like Michael is what I always want to call you. But regardless, man, thank you for doing this. Thanks for jumping on Twitch with all the people and doing the podcast. Anything else to tell the people before I let you go?
I mean, thank you guys for coming to listen. I hope you all had an awesome holidays. I hope you have an amazing new year. Look out for more stuff from us. And Shane, you know, thank you as always for bringing me on. It's something that I've always wanted to do too. And it was thankfully, it was somebody on Twitter who posted it and I was like, oh yeah, that'd be fun. I'm going to write him. Sure enough, here we are.
I know. I'm so glad it happened. I mean, yeah, obviously your name's like been in the works like forever and I've just been like meaning to get in touch and I think now with Signals having a record out and everything it's a perfect time to talk so thanks so much. I'll let you go. I'm going to stick around on Twitch a little bit and talk to the people and it's been fun. Take care, man.
Awesome. All right. Thank you guys. Have a safe day. Happy new year.
See ya. There it is with Michael. Man, that Taco Bell dollar menu, it's just not the same as what it used to be. I'll tell you, man, especially in Canada, you know how much they're charging for a 7-layer burrito these days? And they got smaller. Taco Bell, if you're listening, man, you failed me. You failed me, dude. Anyway, that was a great conversation. I want to thank him again so much for doing that. Thank you for listening, for subscribing, for checking out the All Access Club, for following me on Twitch. All awesome stuff. And there's some great stuff coming up all year long. You don't want to miss it. Anyway, I will leave you with a tune. Here is new music from Signals, Michael's new project. This song is called Not If I Save You First on Lead Singer Syndrome. Peace and love. See you next time.
worth your time.
Might be worth the time.